Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by my good friend and co-host, Jennifer Hashley. Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Aaron.
Hey, Jennifer, it sounds like you might be far away in a car, not in the studio with me right now.
You got that right. Today's been a very busy day out there networking and meeting with folks that teach horticulture at community colleges and trying to build partnerships to build our food system. So I'm sorry I'm not at the studio quite yet, but I'm making my way there.
That's okay. We're looking forward to having you in-house for the second half. And, you know, I get, when I send over mailers to you or information to you, I get the response, you are all over the country making these great things happen. You're quite the advocate doing great things. So let me read a little bit about your background, which I do. And every time we do this, I shorten it down little bit by little bit. I know our audience is getting familiar with it, but Jennifer started the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project. It is one of the first initiatives nationwide to help immigrants and refugees develop commercial farming opportunities. Now, 20 years in, Jennifer's goal remains to help new farmers excel in the field, and New Entry gives them the tools to do that. It's a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation, economic growth for regions often in need, and stimulus. Additionally, Jennifer, in partnership with her husband, Pete, Jennifer also runs a diversified pasture-based livestock operation and Pete and Jen's Backyard Birds, which recently transitioned to the renowned Codman Community Farm in the heart of Lincoln, Massachusetts. Boy, we are lucky to have Jennifer on our side and to have Jennifer as our co-host. Thanks for joining, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
All right, so let's talk about a few things to begin our conversation. First, Thanksgiving. We're talking earlier about Thanksgiving, and I don't want to talk about the meal per se, but some of the information I consumed during the weekend of Thanksgiving. So I was listening to NPR, which a lot of us do up here in their petri dish of the Northeast, and the day following Thanksgiving, I heard a piece on NPR focused on young farmers. It was a 5-minute segment that pointed out some very cool programs for these young farmers. Stuff like AgLink, which is out of Iowa State. It's a database that connects tomorrow's farmers with those that have the land that currently can be farmed. They compared it to being a bit like a dating platform for your succession plan. Interesting. The segment also mentioned interesting tools from the business side of things for future farmers. They shared stories of classroom courses on the reality of farming that helps reduce the starry eyes and the rose-colored glasses. And effectively, it was a relatively short segment, but they did discuss a broad tapestry of potential fixes to big problems being worked on now. So despite the woe is me beginning, which talked about the average age of the American farmer is over 60 years old, and it will be that way forever. It will never change. And the close, which was focused on these insurmountable problems that are facing our young farmers, I was impressed by the core sustenance of the piece, mostly because it focused on a lot of the solutions, the positivity. And leading into today's discussion, I searched online for the article regarding this radio segment, hoping to use it as an expression of potential and positive impact. I found it, and it was titled, probably apropos, "For Young Farmers in the U.S., More Challenges Lie Ahead." And I said, what? What are we talking about here? So we do have challenges. These are real. But instead of continuing to promote and tease only these perils, which most media and journalists do, let's look at the problems as just being the reality and elevate these solutions to those problems as being what's noteworthy. So, damn you, NPR. Stop with these fluff pieces. Stop with the exposé. Stop with the clickbait of things. You know, we know that we have some NPR folks that listen to the show. So there it is. I'm throwing the gauntlet down right there and saying, get under the hood and explore why the folks addressing these known and pressing issues are so important. To refocus the lens, to stop burying the lead and promote hope and potential of what could and will be instead of more woe is me.
I couldn't agree with you more.
What's that?
I said, I couldn't agree with you more. How are we going to attract the future farmers into this, you know, into this industry if it's all doom and gloom and challenge and impossibility?
Yeah, no doubt about it. Let me just close by saying this last thing to the intro, because I wanted to get that out there, because I got to get my funny piece in here, Jennifer. With all this negativity, no wonder all of our farmers are growing so old so fast. Huh? There you go. Save that to the end. We'll work on that again. So, Jennifer, let's talk about that. So, oh, man, we got all these problems. I know we do. Tomorrow's food, tomorrow's farming, fishing workforce. Is there hope, Jennifer? Do we see potential and capacity for this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we have to change the dominant narrative that there's no future in farming, that everyone's getting old, all this land is going to change hands, there's nobody who wants to farm. Because there are young people and career changers and others who are called to the land and who want to grow food and want to have the lifestyle and want to contribute to their community. I mean, we need to change the narrative to show that it is possible. It is not without its challenges. We have to be realistic, but we need to show a positive, you know, there needs to be an agricultural career pathway that is illuminated, that addresses the challenges. Policy needs to take a piece of this and play into it. And yeah, we have to show hope for the future generation or I don't know what. Yeah. We're all going to be wandering, you know, sitting around in Wall-E world, you know, hoping that technology saved us and wondering where the last green, you know, green plant is coming from.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So drop the mic on that. That's a great statement you just made there, Jennifer. Just don't do it in the car. Wait till you park before you do that, okay? So, but actually, before we move on to there, speaking of clickbait, you know, so I went looking for this article, and I can't believe what news sources actually provide clickbait, but I got drawn in by one of those that was talking about this. They were talking about the Little Hercules, this guy, aka the world's strongest boy. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but it's pretty fantastic. It's this tiny little Ukrainian kid. He's all tanned up, and he's like super ripped. It turns out they did this whole little expose. I followed the entire like slideshow, which you should not do. But I know that every piece of my information is now exploring the cyberspace. But the Ukrainian kid named Richard that has this crazy dad who overtrained him. His dad later went to jail for domestic abuse. You know what you think of this poor crazy lifestyle this kid has. He was burned out by 15. He's now a stuntman in Hollywood. He's got a bit of a dad bod at late 20s. And he's looking for meaning in his life. Maybe food and agriculture could be that meaning. Richard, so if you're listening, we'll get you set up and nicely and queued up for that. But hey, Jennifer, you brought us some wonderful and special guests today to talk about the future of food systems, the future of agriculture, and the potential for this as an incredible work and innovation economy. So first, let's start with Dorothy Saput, who's the founder and executive director of the Carrot Project. Hey, Dorothy, how you doing?
Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Hey. I'm good. Yeah,
yeah, doing this all right. Is great. Thank you.
Well, it is our pleasure.
Thank you for having me. And hi, Jen.
Hi, Dorothy. Glad to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice.
It's you guys have known each other for a long time. I'm excited when we all get in the room here and have this conversation. We also have joining us today is Julia Shanks, who's the senior business advisor for the CARE Project, and she also runs the Julia Shanks Food Consulting. Julia, how you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. It is always our pleasure. You're telling us some interesting things about your Thanksgiving meal. You made some great things happen in the kitchen.
Absolutely. Actually, I had a good friend who's a farmer up visiting me. And as a farmer, he actually doesn't sit still very well. So he came to my house for Thanksgiving and I was all prepared to cook. And he kept saying, Julia, give me a task. And he ended up cooking the whole meal, which was terrific.
Wow, that is a task.
And he cleaned up after himself.
Is he available for next Thanksgiving?
I'm open.
All right, Dorothy, let's talk about your background and how this led to an impetus for the CARE Project. Okay, so Dorothy Saput is the founding and executive director of the CARE Project. Dorothy's commitment to a sustainable food system grew out of the incredible contrast between Midwestern agriculture, where she grew up, and locally focused food farming systems in Switzerland, where she lived after graduating with a BS from Purdue University. Following graduate school at Tufts, Dorothy worked as a first regional organizer of the 1995 Farm Bill for the Northeast Sustainable Agricultural Working Group under the auspice of the Campaign for Sustainable Agriculture and subsequently as a consulting for business and agency. Dorothy, so let's ask this. Let's talk about this. What problems did you see when you first started the CARE Project? And with that, what have you launched to address those problems?
Yeah. So the problems I saw really were focused on the fact that there were these amazing, kind of going back to the young people that are interested in farming, there were a lot of people entering agriculture. They were very excited to be farming. They had good production skills. They knew what they were doing. They knew their craft. They had, you know, a market. They were excited. They had access to land. They were doing all the right things. And then they would get to a point in their career where maybe they, you know, thought, well, I need to make an investment in this business. I want it to go on for many years, and they would run into difficulties finding capital to do that. And an example would be a community-supported agriculture project that I was a part of up on the North Shore in Massachusetts, and they were unable to get a loan to purchase a tractor, something pretty basic. And so that kind of, and that I saw that happen in various iterations over and over again, and I thought, well, what's wrong here? Here are people that are doing good work, that have markets, that, you know, are doing the right things. People are excited about their food. They love what they're doing. And why can't they get something simple like a loan? So that kind of led to kind of digging in and saying, well, what's going on there? Why is that happening? And it led to eventually the creation of the Carrot Project. But that was after kind of doing some research and figuring out that there was pretty much a disconnect between, for many reasons, the lenders, the people that were providing capital, and then the farmers in terms of what they thought. You know, they thought they would go into a bank and be laughed out of the bank. And the bankers were like, well, we have plenty of money. They just don't do business plans. And so there was some, you know, disconnect going on. And so we hope to form the Carrot Project basically to figure out if we could start to address that.
Huh. Must have been a fascinating learning experience because, you know, there's been so many different evolutions within the financial markets around this, and looking at it like, okay, I'm a young farmer. I have no assets to use as a premise of building, getting access to debt. I have, and obviously this is not like a traditional venture model where there's people are, you're actually trying to bridge in real assets and getting access to real assets to create a new rev of an innovation economy. So many challenges intertwined into this thing, right? So how did you find the community to be adoptive of this, from the major stakeholders that actually control those access to the capital,
yeah,
and to the other ones that are looking for it?
Yeah, so it started with some pilot work. We were working with a farmer up in Maine who'd been in business for a while but had run into some difficulties. It was Lee Straw of Straw's Farm. And he had been farming long enough that he knew that he had some time to figure out what he had had some issues with and how to figure that out. And we wanted to help him somehow. So we worked with a bank, Abdermascotta Bank, to say, hey, if we provided a guarantee for Lee, would you be able to give him a loan to get him through this rough spot? And they said yes. And so the idea of providing a guarantee to a lender so that they'll make a loan that they might not make otherwise was kind of the premise of doing that. And at the same time, we did all this different research trying to understand, well, why weren't people getting loans? The original premise was maybe it was because they were using environmentally friendly production methods and bankers didn't know what those were or something like that. And it really turned out to be people's business models. They weren't doing what the lenders were used to. So if you were up in northern Maine and you weren't growing blueberries or potatoes, or you weren't a dairy farmer in other parts of the New England, they weren't sure what to do with you. They weren't sure why you were going to get, they weren't sure how you could base your prices and what you thought you were going to bring into your farm. They didn't understand the market. And so that led to them not being able to get that money. And that was happening at the same time that the banking, as we were kind of developing these new markets, these bankers, the whole lending industry consolidated and changed. And so there was a lot of loss of agricultural knowledge as well. And I was at an investor circle conference, yeah, which is a group of venture capitalists that work in are looking to invest in sustainable things. And in a small conversation about trying to figure out how do you do something in food and agriculture. And at one point, a guy named Eric Becker, who was with Trillium Asset Management at one point.
Yep, in Vermont, sure.
You know, yeah. And now he's up in Vermont.
He's at Clean Yield now.
He's at Clean Yield Asset Management now. But we were just looked at each other and said, everybody's talking about way up the food chain, way up the value chain, up into retail businesses and other types of, you know, end products for retailers. And we were like, we want to talk about farmers.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, there's this problem. We have all this research that says, you know, these farmers are saying they can't get the capital they need. And he was like, I know people that would, you know, help provide those guarantees that you need. And so that was really the beginning.
And I think one of the great things that you also did was you started to work with the lenders and training them to understand the risk profile of a farmer and what does it look like to invest in farmers. So not just getting the farmers ready for financing and guaranteeing the loans, but getting the lenders and the bankers more familiar with agriculture so they felt more comfortable investing.
That's fascinating. It's a finding a common language, a nomenclature that everyone can then speak and feel comfortable with. It seemed a bit also like maybe, with the loss of some of our regional instances of farm credit, which was supposed to fill some of this void back in the day, there was nothing available. So I wonder, were you a bit like everyone's parents who co-signed the loans for them?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
right.
A great way of putting it.
All
I
right.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that too.
Well, good.
Thank you.
All right. You can use that. All right. Hey, Julia, let's talk about your background and how this interrelates, obviously, with the CARE Project and some of the other work that you're involved in. So Julia Shanks brings a broad range of professional experience to her clients, from pilot to chef to serial entrepreneur. Julia received her professional training as a chef at the California Culinary Academy of San Francisco, has a BA from Hampshire College, and an MBA from Babson College right around the bend here in Wellesley. After more than 10 years of professional cooking, Julia became a college professor of accounting and now works with food businesses and farms, helping them maximize profits and streamline operations through business planning, feasible studies, and operational audits. Julia's book, The Farmer's Office, provides tips, tools, and templates for farmers to successfully manage and grow farm business. So, Julia, you literally wrote the book on the modern small mid-sized farm back office. What do we focus on? How did you put this together and realize, oh, it's so much different than the big farm, it's so much different from the farm in the 1950s? How'd you codify that? And then how does that implement with the CARE Project?
Wow. It's a long story.
It sounds like it from your background. It's like there's no straight line for anyone's background. I get it.
Well, what happens is, you know, I'm working with clients for the CARE Project for Dorothy, and they come and they need money, or maybe they come to me because they're not making money. They need to figure out how to make money. And so the first question I'll ask them is to see their books. Hmm. And then they look at me and stare. Well, what's that? And so people are asking the question, how do I make more money? How do I increase profits? And then they don't know, they don't have anything to go back on.
Yeah.
So after working with a whole bunch of clients over the years, realizing that we need to step back a few paces, that we can't answer all the questions that farmers have, how can I be financially sustainable if we don't have any records of what they've done so that we can answer the questions and look at what they're doing? And actually, I got started in this because I was working with a farmer. And we started calculating his cost of production, and we discovered that he was making 10 cents a pound on tomatoes. And his theory was he wanted to be a tomato farmer. He was going to, you know, focus on tomatoes. And we started calculating how much it cost. And at 10 cents a pound, you cannot produce enough tomatoes to be profitable.
Yeah.
It's just not doable. So you have to rethink your whole business model. But, you know, he's just kind of chugging along and growing more and selling more and losing more. Because he doesn't know where he makes his money.
Yeah, that is a tough way to go out. That's a lot of poundage of tomatoes, which is a tough perishable to begin with.
Yep.
And without a value add. So what do you look at when you break that down? You said, okay, you're getting 10 cents per. Do you open up as a organization the opportunity to add value add, to look at new distribution channels, to look at reducing seasonality?
Mm-hmm.
Do you kind of make this a case study that you sit as a team and try to orchestrate a plan for them?
Usually it works a little bit different.
Okay.
We start out with them actually coming, as Julia said, either looking for money or financing or stuck somehow in their operation. And we really want to go with what they want to go. Because when you think about farms, right, and we think about any small business, certain farms, they have different assets. They have different land base. They have different skills. They have different markets. They want to grow different products. And so I would say it's a farmer-led process in terms of working with them to figure out what makes sense for them, because ultimately it's their business.
Yeah.
And it has to work for them. It doesn't, you know, and so that's really the basis of it. And so it is very much a process of discovery to understand both them and where they are, and then working with them over time to kind of, you know, help set goals, which Jennifer would be familiar with, you know, kind of looking back at what are they actually trying to accomplish and what do they want to be doing, you know, because obviously that's going to, that optimism and that goal and their vision is what's going to drive them to do the hard work of, you know, kind of buckling down on the parts that many people don't like as much. But yeah, as one of our farmers always says, you know, looking at your books and working with your numbers allows you to do what you love.
Sure.
And so that's what we really focus on.
Julia, you had another thought?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking, you asked, what do you do with a farmer that's only making 10 cents a pound on tomatoes, and what are your options? And one of your options is to focus on other crops and understanding, okay, well, if I make this much money on this crop, what about the others? And as a farmer, you know, selling retail in the DC area, you need to have tomatoes. So the tomatoes become the loss leader. It's what brings people to your farm stand, and then you can sell the more profitable crops. But you don't know where to focus your energy if you don't know what is the most profitable aspect of your business.
Right. Jennifer, you are involved in the CARE Project as an advisor, but you come at it obviously through New Entry and working with the next generation of workers. What did you see as an appeal to the project, and how do you find yourself contributing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I find that one of my goals is, I mean, the whole purpose of New Entry is to get new farmers to start farming. So I feel like we're the precursor to the great work that the Carrot Project is doing. So we're the ones that take the starry-eyed explorers, aspiring farmers, wannabe business folks, and run them through our business planning course, have them do those enterprise budgets and look at the analysis of how much crops are going to cost them to produce, how much they could possibly make, and then develop their first year startup business plan. And then we put them on our incubator, and then we help them start marketing through our food hub. But then they get onto our land, and eventually they need to leave the incubator and go start farming. And that's really about the point where they have a couple of years of financial statements and records. And then we hope to be able to make effective referrals to folks like the CARE Project, who can sit down with them and help them reassess, you know, it's time to get your records into QuickBooks. It's time to look at whether a loan makes sense for you. It's time to make this next investment. Let's look at how you're keeping your financial house in order and help you get to the next level. So if we're trying to build that pipeline, then we want to make sure that there are people that can also continue to help provide business technical assistance and support to the farmers that we're creating. And so unless we want to continue to just do everything ourselves, which is not practical, we need strong partnerships, and that's why I was attracted to the Carrot Project, to see how we could, you know, collaborate together and build this effective pipeline of ongoing support for our graduates.
Jennifer brings up some interesting points around looking at different outcome measures. There's a clear and evident one here of the loan being repaid and everyone happy that the co-signing is done and the parents can move forward. But obviously this is a lot focused on some place-based investing. There's many aspects of double impact associated to this, whether it's sustainable ag, it's urban agriculture. You know, you probably could take a handful of these items that would make sense besides just the financial returns. So, Dorothy, how do you effectively look at successful outcome measures, and then how do you use that information to modify the program?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I guess one of the things, just to step back for a second so I can answer that question, is that, well, we started with lending. We've been in business for 12 years. And what we've seen is that there's been, and this goes to the optimism that things change and things are changing for the better, is that we started with lending. But what we found was that over time, there was more capital coming in to the market to do this type of lending, whether it was from Farm Credit, from the United States Department of Agriculture, from a lot of individuals and, you know, other types of alternative lenders. And what we, at the same time that was happening, we were learning that not only did people need money, but they needed, you know, some of the work, that the type of work that Julia was talking about before. And so when we're looking, and so that kind of set it up that, yeah, we continue to do lending, but we do a lot more of this kind of business advice and coaching to really help people kind of their business sing in a way that they can graduate from our program and kind of, I guess, enter the regular market, whatever that is. And so in terms of what we measure, the way that I like to think about it is that this emphasis on economic viability, on being able to make a profit, what that allows you to do is everything else you want. And so thinking of a farm that we worked with, the Bug Hill Farm way back then. They now recently switched owners, but, you know, when she started with us, she had this idea in her head of, like, what was this farm going to look like? And she was able to purchase marginal land, meaning land that wasn't super productive. It was really rocky, and it wasn't going to produce, it wasn't going to support cows. It wasn't going to support a lot of diversified vegetables or anything like that. So she looked and said, well, what can this land do? And she was able to figure out that it can grow a lot of different fruits, a lot of different bush fruits, like blueberries and raspberries and certain trees and things like that, as well as wild ones. And from that, she then developed a variety of different products. And so what we were doing was kind of helping her develop those products. And we were looking for, not develop the products and the markets and helping her support that thinking. But at the end, what she was looking at, her long-term goals were to pay herself, to be able to support the farm, and then to be able to have the position in a place that a young person could take it over five to 10 years later. And that's now happened. And so when we think about what the metrics are, they're tied to the economic viability. And then behind that is, the production methods that people want to use, the markets they reach, the things they want to give back to the community, all those different things in terms of, possibly being able to buy land later. Those are the other type of metrics, in addition to traditional things like jobs and have you paid back your loan and things like that. So we really look to, we have an intake process, and we're looking for people that really want to kind of, they're thinking about, how is my business going to give back to the community? So that changes a little bit from business to business, but those are some of the things that we look at.
It is interesting because you've almost seen a coaxing, maybe a epiphany of a lot of the impact world, which once was based off of philanthropy, the idea that you have to have core business functionality, the fundamentals down to be a sustainable farm. You have to be a sustainable business. More greater good can, when you have the resources, yeah, come associated to that, right?
So, absolutely.
And I think that was a bit of a misnomer that we were going to change the world of agriculture by doing it on the good graces of our heart, right? Now we have to look at this differently and understand that it comes from sound business decisions. And really, if we're going to implement this type of change, which we need to do at scale in the time period, we got to use free markets to be associated with this, right?
Yep.
So, Julia, let's come to you on that and talk a little bit about what these financial models are telling us, what information we can get out of that, and what that really brings forward for the business leaders here. What have you found from working with different farmers and producers when you get the books in order, when you provide the information? What kind of decisions can they make?
Well, it's about helping the farmers stay on the land and keep on farming. So they want to do that. And so understanding how they can make a profit and reading the numbers, because, everybody needs to make a living, and we've got several options. And, being sustainable as a farmer, being a profitable farmer, or relying on grants, which unfortunately I've seen a lot of farmers do, but is not sustainable. And then there's all the developers that are coming in and offering prime money for land to put up housing. And certainly in this area in New England, where real estate is so hot. So how do we ensure that the farmers can stay on the land is helping them to run profitable businesses. And, that goes back to being place-based, in that we want our food to come from our community. And if we can protect our farmland and protect the farmers so that they can earn a living, then we can maintain our local food economy and not rely on California or Mexico or wherever else, China.
Right. It's, I think it would create a unique opportunity for us to have a different perspective on this. There's obviously a lot of interest there, but it seems you are now giving the business model behind this. And Dorothy, let me continue in that thought and ask, if you have the business model to prove out this can work, you got the interested stakeholders involved. Are you, after your 12 years here, are you developing a scalable model that can be not just within our place, but anyone's place?
Yeah, I think I would flip that question just a little bit, because we're trying to develop local economies. And so the question is what does scalability mean? Does it mean replication of many smaller organizations like the CARE Project, or does it mean to become like the IBM or the Apple or something of this entity? And I would think that Apple is a little not isn't about developing local economies.
Right.
And so when you think about scalability of the type of work that the Carrot Project does happen, and it happens in a lot of different ways. I'm part of a growing coalition of organizations that do business assistance across the Northeast. Some of them are, you know, kind of structured as a nonprofit like the Carrot Project, which has been working in Massachusetts and parts of New York. Another one is funded in the Hudson Valley purely by money from different counties to do similar work. And then another one is funded through the Vermont legislature. And so there's a lot of different ways that you can get to the point where you can do this business development. Our particular model is focused on low to moderate income business owners, as well as people that are starting up. They're not really making any money or very little. And that's a place where philanthropy can be important, because we don't have any other way to start building these business models. For places that are working with more advanced farmers that are farther along in their stage where they're making money, then, you know, if there's more room there to convince a legislator that you're, you know, you have a history, you have a track record, there's something there that you, a legislator can hang their votes and their hat on, and they're more likely to, you know, find ways to fund programs that support businesses that are older and have been around a lot longer and have a certain track record. So I think there's a lot, there's many different opportunities to scale and, you know, kind of scale what's out there and what we know and what we learn. And we know that there's interest in it, because this group of 50 or so organizations, and we're working under the rubric of the blueprint right now, but we need a better name than that. You know, there's interest in it from as far away as Oregon, Northern California, Central, you know, upper Midwest, as well as part of the South. So we know that there is interest in figuring out how do we change agriculture using kind of economic viability as its core.
Interesting. Yeah, it's I get so ingrained, Jennifer, in the mindset of these approaches being intellectual property, like a methodology, that I think of scalability as being a replicable model that could be put in other spots. But you brought up an excellent point that I'm not asking if you're going to challenge and take over the world with the Carrot Project, but is this a framework that could then scale? Similar to, Jennifer, what's happening with New Entry, maybe you can comment a little bit. I've pressed you a couple times on this. I'm going to ask again, if you had unlimited resources to look at this as a new mechanism of jobs creation in this country, how would you intertwine this whole holistic perspective?
Yeah, I go back to what we've been talking about earlier about a lot of what the work we're talking about is place-based and is local and regional economic development. And I think that's what we've kind of lost sight of, is the connection to land and how land is such a grounding force in the food system. And it's so obvious, but we've looked at how the food system has developed and become this commoditized, industrialized, you know, aggregated global distribution system. And I think we lose sight of what does it mean to be in a community, working a piece of land, caring for the soil, caring for the natural environment resources, caring for the people who work on the land, caring for all people in the whole value chain of food production. And that can't be grown to an unsustainable level, which we're nearing at this point. I feel like we've been moving and expanding and growing and scaling. And so I think what New Entry is working on, what Dorothy's working on, what countless other organizations that care about local and sustainable agriculture are working on, are trying to bring the food system back to a reasonable scale. That's land-based, place-based, people-based food production. And that is not something that, you know, I mean, we've tried it, right? We've tried this growth at all cost model, and we're seeing the outcomes of that right now. And so there's a place in scale for, in nature, frankly, for duplication, replication, built-in resiliency by having a lot of different things interacting at different levels. And if we lose the base of small-scale, local, sustainable, community-based, regional, local economies, you know, we need all of it to make the system work. And so bringing it back down to, you know, lots of little initiatives sometimes may not be efficient or economically efficient, but we have to still work in the communities at the community scale that makes sense.
And I would just add to that, I think the other thing is that in the context of, we're basically recreating a new food system. And so there's a lot of R&D that has to happen as well. And so a lot of the players in a lot of the nonprofits and are doing that. But what we like to think of, like the CARE Project, like we have these graduates, and these graduates then are going on to work with Farm Credit. They're going on to work within the commercial, they're playing in actors in their commercial marketplace. And ultimately, they're able to pay the fees of private consultants as well. Whereas they might not be able to when they're, you know, they get out of college, they have student loans, they never have a job. And so when you think about who has access to participating in the food system and starting a farm, we're looking at it and say we want that access to be as broad as possible. It doesn't mean that ultimately they're not going to enter our regular marketplace, but we want to help them get there, and we don't want it to be just the people that have the financial wherewithal to kind of make this investment over time to build these businesses and then enter the marketplace, because there's a whole lot of people that would be left out.
Yeah. It is an interesting case study for a circular economy associated to Know Your Farmer. I mean, really is. So you're describing Jennifer and Dorothy as something that takes kind of a little bit of a namesake, or maybe like an anecdotal aspect of Know Your Farmer. This is the key for the local. But it really, if this is an economic model associated to it. And Julie, do you have a comment about that?
Well, I was going to say part of the issue of scalability is that each region has its own particularities. Like here in New England, you know, land is expensive, and we also have a very close marketplace. But then I was in West Virginia a couple of weeks ago, and the land isn't really productive for diversified vegetable farming. It's more for livestock and hay because it's hilly and it's rocky, and you don't have access to the same kinds of markets that you do here in New England. And if you go into the Midwest, you know, you have lots of land, and the markets are farther out. So trying to create a scalable model is difficult because you need to be regionally focused to what the land concerns are, the market concerns, what grows well in your region. You can't just kind of do a one-size-fits-all solution all over the country.
Hmm.
I think we also have to recognize the role of policy in all of this. And, you know, I feel like that's really been a defining force of the kind of food system that we want. I mean, we stopped supporting...
Can you say an example of what kind of policy we could do? Because you mentioned that earlier, and I was curious to know.
I mean, I think, you know, going back to the whole anecdote of, you know, it's not even an anecdote, but, you know, the Earl Butts, get big or get out. I mean, we started incentivizing, you know, planting fence row to fence row and continuing to, you know, rip out conservation buffers and be as productive as possible and growth, and, you know, created our incentivized systems to, you know, eliminate, you know, market, you know, price floors and seal, you know, price floors to keep, you know, keep the supply and demand in check. Like that all kind of stripped out, and we went to this free market capitalistic system. And so the only way that you grow and make more money is to continue to get bigger and bigger. And then we started seeing consolidation and then agribusiness, and, you know, just continued to, you know, scale and efficiencies and cheap food and all of that has just, I think, gotten a little bit out of hand. And we're starting to see the fallout of that. I mean, looking at, you know, listening to the news again this morning of the dairy crisis and, mm-hmm. you know, farmers committing suicide because they just, when your whole livelihood in life, you know, generations behind you is built on, you know, farming and owning this land and doing the stewardship, and then you just can't make it anymore and you're the last on the line. I mean, that's pretty devastating. And we're seeing, you know, how many 80 dairy farms go out of business in Wisconsin and so many are all around the place, and not respecting, you know, how does policy step in and, you know, take a hard look at what kind of food system we want and land use and rural communities and all the things that we're looking at right now. And I don't know what the solution is. And I think our Congress and really smart people are trying to figure out this right now. And hopefully we'll have a farm bill in the next couple of weeks. And, but I think it's going to be more of the same.
But it's just in the New York Times today, too, that the soybean farmers are suffering from a drought and then the trade war with China, that the price of soybeans are plummeting. And so they're relying on subsidies rather than being able to sell their product.
Yeah, they're getting one-tenth from what the statistics show, one-tenth of the value of what they've lost in the trade tariffs, the soybean, dairy, major infrastructure, major commodities here. And I'll just, to Jennifer's point, thank goodness we've got solutions of change, huh, Jennifer? Because all those problems, they are there. But we're moving this whole thing forward, which I get excited by, and I understand the policy side. It's so much easier to throw your hands up and to question, like, how can this be, and the corruption and the hubris and all of these approach that, you know, food just becomes that mechanism of what really shows kind of some of the intent that man has had over our influence on land and our relationship to natural order. now's our chance to solve many of these problems. And I'm so excited for what the Carrot Project's doing to address some of these issues by starting at the fundamental grassroots and looking at that. So what can we expect from you all in the future? What are we going to get in the next 12 years?
Yeah, I hope that we can continue to work with, you know, our goal is to have increasingly more, you know, more numbers of people that are economically viable. So I think just plugging away, and what we're seeing is there's starting to be kind of pods of people that are able, farmers that are able, they're successful, they're able to mentor one another, they're helping one another. It's not just having to go to a, you know, somebody else, but they're able to help and mentor one another and work together in different ways on markets. And so I think it's really building up the group of people that can work together and kind of further everything on their own, because right. Yeah, I think that's where we're going.
Okay. Julia?
Well, I'm thinking a lot about helping farmers grow, because, you know, we were talking about scaling at all costs, and I think scaling at all cost is not right for everybody. But there is a certain level of scale that we need to get to be financially viable as farmers, or as the farmers want to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, learning the skills of running a business and not just running a farm. So, you know, learning how to manage the books, learning how to manage people, because as you start to get to a certain scale, you can't do everything yourself. So you have to start hiring out. And so I've been thinking a lot about that next phase when the farmer is earning 500,000 to a million, which isn't really huge. Mm. It's still a pretty small scale, but you can't do it all yourself. So you need to start learning new skills to manage and market and sell and operate and understand the numbers to make it all still work.
Take you out of the hobby farmer and make you a full-time farmer, even though you're a small business, but moving in that direction, right?
Yep.
And capacity building, which is sure seems to be lost because much of the things we talked about on the policy side, the get in, get bigger, get out, has formulated us lost, this generational loss of people that know how to do that.
Can I just add that I think one of the things, you know, when we think about what we're going to do for the next 12 years or whatever, it's also like, where are we? Yeah. Right. In the New England, we're producing less than 5% of our food supply here. And so we have a lot of work for the Carrot Project and other organizations to work many years where we're, you know, making a huge impact that we're able to change things. Yeah. And so I think it's continuing and buckling down and doing more and figuring out how to do that and how to spread both the knowledge so more and more farmers can benefit from it and people. Rather than, you know, kind of stick with your guns and do what's working, because we're not there yet.
Yeah.
Jennifer, and it's interesting. Yeah. I was just going to say, too, the USDA definition of a beginning farmer is someone in their first 10 years of business. So when we think about, you know, the whole local food movement's really only been around for 10 or 15 years. Some people may say it goes all the way back to the back to land movement in the early 70s or whatnot. But that's still only 30 or 40 years, which is, you know, three or four generations, I guess, of quote-unquote beginning farmers really trying to figure this out. And so I think we have a lot of learning to do as a sector and a movement. And it takes a long time to invest in one individual and their business and get it to a certain scale and size, which is why we should think about not only just getting new people into this, but really trying to figure out what is the sustainable business model for people that are already farming. How do they pass it on to their next generation? And that work is, I feel like, that's a whole separate thing, succession planning and all of that. And I feel like we work more in the space of trying to get new people who didn't grow up on family farms and come from that history and don't have the land and the opportunity and the baggage that comes with that inheritance, but people that want to get into it. And so there's all different scales and sizes to be working in.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I'll put a link to the Carrot Project and some of your work at the bottom of the write-up. I'll just close by saying, so yes, clickbait works. I feel much more connected to my good friend Little Hercules, seeing that he needs more of a meaning in life and some hope and potential, and the solutions of change are real. So maybe he does have a place in farming and agriculture, and we can bring him in. Strong hands, good tenacity.
Absolutely.
That would do well on the farm, right? But I think what it comes down to for our folks at NPR or us as a collective or anyone, let's promote the potential, the hope and potential of tomorrow, so we get tomorrow's farmers to look at this positively, tomorrow's eaters to look at this positively, and then we're all part of this grander solution. So I can't thank you all enough for partaking in today's conversation. I've enjoyed it. I know our audience will learn a great deal. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.